Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. Today, I'm joined by James Mishrecki, founder of Skin & Me, a personalised prescription skincare company now valued at $160 million. Essentially, you do a consultation online, a dermatology team creates a custom formula and it arrives monthly. It's a heavily regulated space, which makes it hard to replicate, and that's partly why James chose it. But before skincare, James was actually a professional poker player. And as you'll hear, the crossover between those two worlds runs deeper than you might expect. We talked about risk, resilience, and the emotional brutality of building a company, including one weekend in 2023 when Silicon Valley Bank collapsed and James thought he'd lost absolutely everything. What struck me most about this conversation was James's honesty about what drives him. He describes himself as addicted to company building. And by the end, I think you'll understand what he means by that. Let's get into it. James, thank you for joining me today. Now, you went from professional poker to building a £160 million skincare business. On your LinkedIn, you said, "I highly recommend poker to anyone considering starting a company because it teaches you everything from risk management to resilience to psychology." Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of crossovers, I think. Resilience is in both of them because everything will go wrong all the time. And you've got to just accept that as part of the game and learn to enjoy it. And I think, one big crossover between the two things like poker and startups is you're always making decisions with incomplete information. And you just got to build comfort with that and accept that you're never going to get much more than 60, 70% confidence in the information to make a key decision. But you ultimately have to detach from the outcome and just like focus on the process and the learning.
And what's your philosophy when it comes to risk taking? Because I'm sure like a lot of entrepreneurs, myself included, have had to learn a lot of hard lessons about that. And we're fed this kind of rhetoric that, oh, you should bet on yourself and, you know, take the leap and you'll regret the chances you didn't take. But that can be kind of reckless and it can go horribly wrong. What's your take on that?
Well, I think I maybe view risk a bit differently, like just stuff that I think a lot of people would view as risky just doesn't bother me. I mean, I've never had a job and I've never had to rely on an income from a job or anything like that. And so early on in my career, I was taking all of these risks in starting companies and most things like didn't work out in the early days, but I conditioned myself to not have a reliance on a steady, predictable income. And so that meant that whenever I was making my next move and for example, starting Skin & Me, it took a long time. I had to put my own money into the business and took a long time to actually get it off the ground. But I didn't have moments of like thinking, oh, this is crazy. I should stop and go out and get a job. And I think that then sort of plays into the mindset of like running and building any of these companies where you're basically making calculated risks all the time. And yeah, some of them are quite daunting because they might be one-way doors that you can't go back from. But I think the more you progress through your entrepreneurial journey, you know, the more comfortable you get making these big calls. And the stakes just get higher, but the game almost stays the same.
You only really hear the good stories, right? When people say, well, I remortgaged my house and I bet all my life, you know, I put all my life savings into it and my kids' college funds. And part of me thinks, well, just because that turned out well doesn't mean that was necessarily a good idea. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you've got to, in order to get your leg up, you've got to do something to get that like first win in entrepreneurship. And some people might spend 10 years working in a job and saving up money so that when they start a business, they've got a real like financial reserves or they can fund it or something like that. And that, you know, in a way that's almost what I, like when it came to starting Skin & Me, I'd already been building a company through my 20s. I started it maybe when I was 30, 31. I'd been building a company all through my 20s, stashing money away once we got it profitable, sucking out dividends and not spending it. And then when I exited that business, all the money was basically used as me for me to have this reserve pot so that I didn't have to worry, right? And so I wasn't put into that position. But yeah, look, I mean, it's inspiring when people do that. And if you really believe in a vision and you can't sleep because you haven't had the chance to bring it to life and you've got to put yourself into financial, like a precarious position like that, then it might be the right thing to do. But I think a lot of people, like me included, have just found like other ways of getting to that same point of being able to still chase your vision.
And you talk about taking calculated risks. I mean, where do you personally draw the line between taking a calculated risk and just kind of being reckless? Like, where is that sort of tipping point for you?
Yeah, I think for me, I just follow my intuition. And once I've got confidence that the vision and the team are really strong, and we feel, especially once we've got product market fit, then I'm just more comfortable placing bigger bets. And I think almost the most exciting thing about building a company over the long run is that you get to keep playing the game just on a higher level, and you get the opportunity, you earn the opportunity to be taking bigger and bigger risks. I don't know if you've seen like the founder of Nvidia, Jensen Huang, talking about this. And even 10, 15 years ago, he was basically saying, look, this is a game of survival. And we just try to play the game as long as we can, and then we can take some bigger risks. And you almost earn that right.
No, for sure. And just going back to your background as a poker player, obviously, I'm not sort of too familiar with all the rules of it, but I know that it obviously requires a great deal of emotional control and restraint. Do you think that's the key to succeeding as an entrepreneur? Because people say, oh, it's not really about how hard you hustle, it's about how resilient you are. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that is the like non-negotiable, right? I think there's a lot of smart people that start companies, but they don't quite realize how brutal it gets, how much it will make you depressed and angry and confused. Is it meant to be this hard? Why am I going through like a 4 month phase of everything going wrong? And what am I doing with my life? And this is incredibly lonely, and I've given up my salary, and like the walls are caving in. It gets intense. And then things do start working, and you've got people that have followed you and got investors that have backed you, and then really big things go wrong, and the pressure's even higher. And I think you intelligence doesn't get you through that. Resilience
No.
gets you through that. And so I think you need that. But when you stack resilience with intelligence and an appetite for risk, I think you then start to build the profile of a really capable founder.
And do you think that resilience has to be something that's ingrained as opposed to something that you can learn as you go?
To be honest, I kind of do. I feel like if you've got to try to teach it to yourself, then you probably shouldn't start a company, because it's a really bad idea starting a company if you have to convince yourself to do so. Like for me, it's I couldn't do anything else, and I need the roller coaster journey. It's what keeps me alive. And I think if someone has to really mentally prepare for the like emotional roller coaster, then it's probably a pretty bad idea.
No, for sure. But I imagine even people like yourself have days where it can just all get a bit too much. I remember listening to you on the other podcast, and you were saying about how the bank you were with went into administration and you thought that you wouldn't be able to access like fund. I mean, how do you manage that in terms of like your emotions that you're
Yeah.
not? Because
That
that's a
was
pretty
definitely
stressful
the,
situation.
yeah, I'd say I've had like two, like, major crises, and that was the worst one in like my business career. And yeah, it caught me very off guard, because you're managing a lot of, I mean, just for context, in both of my companies, we had all of our money in Silicon Valley Bank, and then the bank went bust. You get like up to 85K insured per business, and we had over 13 million pounds in there, and both companies were going to be screwed, frankly. And we got told on the Friday night that the bank was, I mean, the bank came out saying we're going to be fine, and then 4 hours later, the Bank of England said, they're done. And
Oh
so
my God.
it was, yeah, it definitely threw me into a bit of a spiral. But the founder community, we all club together, we try to shift some of the negative sentiment in the media that weekend. And fortunately, HSBC came in to save the day, but I don't think you can prepare for something like crises should only happen like that, hopefully once every 5 to 10 years, but they're absolutely like shocking and terrible, but it never would lead me to give up. I'd have to be like dead or incapacitated to give up, but I wouldn't wish that type of, yeah, I don't want many of those days.
Yeah, before you knew HSBC were coming in, like, how did you get through it?
Yeah, I definitely had, I remember like a 20, 30 minute phase after like a call that I had with my investor on a Saturday morning, realizing no one was coming to save us, of just being like
Yeah.
really a bit lost. It was like a very, very low negative place, because what was fact was all the work I'd done for all of these years to get to this point is now getting ripped away from me. All of it. We're going back to like square one, and all the value I've created, it's all gone. And so that was, yeah, really, really daunting. But the founder community is like very supportive. I had other friends going through, I don't think I had any friends in as bad of a position as me, but other friends going through similar situations with the bank. And we spoke a lot. And it's funny how when the Monday came around and we got saved, we all met up and we all celebrated. Basically, the status quo from Friday is now the status quo today. And that's something to celebrate. And it
Yeah.
does make you appreciate things.
And what were the main things that you learned about that? And what did you kind of learn about yourself as well?
Well, I learned that we should have a smarter cash management policy in my companies, and just because a bank is like has been around for a very long time and is trusted, doesn't mean that you shouldn't diversify your capital in a very low risk way. Yeah, what did I learn about myself? I think what was quite inspiring was I'd not been thrust into that position before, where I was in a really bad spot with with the banking situation. And so I realized, well, I can help m move the situation. Jeremy Hunt was going like on the news, and all this stuff was basically getting said that was really negative about, oh, let these, I mean, I, it,
Screw
you
him,
know, I never
basically.
get, yeah, there's all these comments on all these news articles. Oh, let these like rich founders burn, and like just let the companies fail. Do not bail them out, and all this stuff. And I'm like, hold on a minute. Like, do you know how many jobs, like, this might be
Yeah.
like your children's jobs might be like it at one of these
And
companies, like
suppliers and yeah.
tens of thousands of jobs. And this is incredibly important for the future of our economy. And so, being encouraged to then be like a voice, and I went on to the BBC News and Sky News, all of this, which I've never really done before, but it did feel like, okay, this is the only way. Like, no one's coming to save us, so we've got to try to shift things ourselves. And so it opened my mind to how a group can come together and under like a common purpose, and try to change the narrative.
And how did you feel about being more visible as a founder? Because was that something, were you a bit more behind the scenes up until that point?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the video of me being on BBC News looking like a ghost because I hadn't slept for 2 days wasn't my best moment. But yeah, I think it was just a bit of a shift. Like, okay, I've not really done this before, but either I help the situation and like help the community and myself, or I don't.
And is that something like moving forward that you're sort of more comfortable with or want to do, sort of build more of a personal profile, as well as the businesses? Or are you happy keeping it sort of separate for now?
Yeah, well, I feel like what I want to keep doing in my career is building companies at the convergence of health and technology, and if I can use my own personal profile to, increase my ability to do that, whether it be attracting or building more awareness with investors or potential hires, then yeah, then I'll do more of it. But yeah, I don't see me being like the next Stephen Bartlett podcast host, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not for everyone, that kind of role. And where do you see like the future of personalized health tech? I mean, do you see it kind of really being sort of the way forward? as opposed to like buying stuff over the counter that might not be as potent or might not be like what that person actually needs.
Well, I feel like at Skin and Me, we've really, I think what we're most proud of is we've created this personalized movement. And we really set a new standard and we sort of 100x'd people's expectations. You know, the speed at which they go through the process, the access they've got to a dermatology team anytime, and getting this like personalized daily doser with your name laser etched into it. It just was dramatically different to what people were familiar with. And, you know, I think that's given us like a platform for future innovation, which is really exciting. We feel we've definitely inspired others to follow in our footsteps. And, you know, I mean, I got pitched just the other day, someone is starting a, like a personalized supplements company. And so I think there's going to be more and more of this, and we're going to continue to lead the charge. And and I think, yeah, there's kind of no limit to the categories that it could be applied to.
And I think that personalization is really the way forward with growing consumer cynicism and people sort of call out culture. And there's a lot of misinformation online when it comes to skincare. Do you think personalization is a way of circumnavigating that?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like a massive shift over the last 5 to 7 years has been just customers are more savvy. They understand what ingredients are. There's figures like Caroline Hirons have started like a movement of people just understanding and knowing what they're looking for and being able to like call BS on a brand if they don't live up to their promise. So I do feel like the combination of something that's literally just made for you, it doesn't exist before we make it for you, and you know, integrating that with proven active ingredients that you cannot get on the high street, you know, with like a lot of clinical evidence behind them, is absolutely the way to build maximum trust with customers because that is the best way to get good results.
And then obviously combine with the subscription model because you're getting that repeat business almost automatically. I mean, a lot of subscription-based businesses are launching and some are really successful and others don't unfortunately make it. What do you think the secret is?
Well, I think it's really simple. I feel like if your product has a strong reason for being on a subscription, then it makes sense. But I mean, you see all sorts of brands that just force subscription where it isn't really a natural fit. I mean, I saw a chocolate subscription brand recently. Like, I don't think that is, it's just not necessary, right? So in our case, there is a strong reason. And that is, it's really important that you follow a treatment plan in order to get the best results. And so, if we stopped you and then you kept coming back 2 months later, we wouldn't deliver the health impact that we've set out to. And so, that's in my view, all it comes down to.
And are there any like major misconceptions about subscription-based businesses, have you found?
Yeah, I would say that with the growth in subscriptions, people have become a bit fed up of so many products being on a subscription. And so they kind of, you know, they can be a bit of an instinctive reaction from people of, oh, yet another company trying to make more money from us by billing us on a subscription. And, you know, I think that is a result of, you know, services like Spotify, Netflix, kicking off like this growth, and then a lot of direct-to-consumer brands doing subscription, and then probably, like I said, a lot of brands where it just doesn't make that much sense, like getting drinks or chocolate or coffee on subscription, and having that forced upon you, and sometimes people being like tricked into a subscription, like no one wants that. And so, yeah, like I said, in our case, there's a very strong, it's like absolutely integral to the product performance that people are on a subscription so that they maintain regular usage.
No, that makes sense. And what's the next big sort of problem you want to solve? Is it still within the Skin and Me ecosystem, or is it something entirely new?
So we're always going to be launching into new categories as part of Skin and Me. We call it the And Me portfolio. So we have Skin and Me. We have Hair and Me. We've launched a new brand for anti-aging called Renew and Me. So we have three brands there already, and there's going to be continued expansion over time. I'm personally launching a new venture at the moment, which is in consumer health, which is super exciting. It's in a 41 billion pound category that is dominated by one incumbent, and that incumbent has been using the same technology for 20 years. And we've recruited some of the veterans from that company, and we've developed superior technology. So we're keeping that under wraps. We're launching it early next year, which is super exciting. And then I'll continue to do more and more of that. I love pulling together, an exciting idea and concept in consumer health that delivers superior results to what people get at the moment, and then bringing together team capital behind that compelling vision.
And what is it about the health sector that you're particularly drawn to? Is it just because that people are so focused on health, particularly post-COVID?
I think what I've figured out how to do well is take products to market that deliver a very specific benefit to consumers, like very clear, like problem solution led propositions. And so that's just what like I really enjoy, because I've seen, I've seen the comments that we get from customers when they've had amazing results. It's incredibly rewarding. I've had people tell me, like in person when we get chatting, like, and they hear the Skin of Me get mentioned, and they talk about the impact it's had on their life. And for me, yeah, it's just, yeah, incredibly rewarding. I don't think that I'm the type of founder to build, I don't know, like Road by Hailey Bieber. It requires a very, it's not a very specific problem solution. It's aspirational led. It's like pure brand building. And I think my specific knowledge and skills, just that they're better applied to very precise health problems. And also, it's just, yeah, there's an explosion in health innovation at the moment. It's a fascinating space to be in. I could spend the rest of my life trying to innovate in it, and I wouldn't even scratch the surface.
And is there a category or a market that you're watching closely? Perhaps not Road by Hailey Bieber, but is there any other market that gives you pause and makes you think, oh, okay, that might be an interesting one to move into?
Well, I've got this new category which is in personal care that I'm gearing up to launch early next year. I'm definitely watching closely how the longevity space evolves. I think specifically on early detection and behavioral change that you can adopt in life as a result of that early detection. So you might know companies like Function Health over in the US. So I'm fascinated by that. And then one personal problem that I've experienced is I'm still in my 30s, but I've got early onset arthritis in my shoulder, which is causing me like a lot of problems in life, a lot of pain. It's restricting how I can work out. I can wake up in agony in the middle of the night. And so I'm interested in like in stem cells and cartilage regrowth. And a lot of that is still very embryonic in terms of its readiness for like, say, in the US FDA approval or like mainstream adoption. But I'm learning more and more about that. And I think when you've had a personal history with something, much like I did with Skin and Me, I had really severe acne throughout all my teens. I think you can, you have even more fire to go after the space.
Definitely. Moving on to talking about scaling, what's been the hardest part of scaling your team as your companies have grown? And so how did your role change in ways that you didn't expect?
I think my role is an always-on recruiter, like almost like a talent scout. I think it's so important, and you're constantly having to learn as a company grows. Okay, what is like organizational design evolves as you build the company, and the frustrating thing is you can't just hire a few people early on and then everything works out hunky dory. Like there's new challenges, and some people level up. Other people might not want to. They might want to stay in their comfort zone. You have to bring new people in to take the business to the next phase. But really, my biggest contributor, once a company, like say it's Skin and Me, for instance, I was CEO in the early days, and then I moved into chairman. And so I see my role as more of a strategic support and recruitment.
Funny you mentioned Stephen Bartlett. I was listening to Emma Greed on his podcast a while back, and I think she was taken out of context. I think they kind of stitched her up a little bit, but she said something that along the lines of the people that you start your company with, when you get past the 100K mark, they don't stay with you. And then when you get to the 1 million mark, those people then don't stay with you. Do you agree with that, or are there people that have been with you since the beginning of the journey?
No, I absolutely don't agree with that. I think that maybe what she meant is that the organization evolves and their roles might, someone that's a the helm of a certain function might not stay there because you need to bring in, there might be a marketing manager level, because that's all you needed on day zero, but you need to bring in a CMO once once you've got product market fit. But no, we've got a high percentage of the people that started at Skin and Me on when we raised our seed round are still with the company, including some leadership team members. So yeah, I think that if you bring in the right people, they're incentivized correctly, and they believe in the vision, that they are bought into what their equity could turn into, and they're loving the journey, and they've been a key contributor to it, then they don't really want to walk away from that because it's a piece of them.
Listening to your other podcast again, you mentioned about when you played poker, the reason that you attributed a lot of your success to the fact that you weren't bothered about the money that was on the table. Do you think that's sort of a core principle when it comes to running a successful business? Like, if you're just focusing on the money, then you're sort of destined to come a cropper.
Yeah, I'd say the important thing, I think what I was getting at there is you just have to learn to detach from the outcome. And you just focus on the because you can't control the outcome. And it's the same in poker, and it's the same in business, right? But what you can control is the process and the learning, and do you change how you make decisions the more that you learn? But nothing is guaranteed. And so it's the same in poker. You can make the right calls, or you can make certain bets, and as long as you've been learning from your previous mistakes, even if you lose money making that bet, but you know that you did it with you were operating in the right way, then yeah, you just have to have a disregard for the money. If you sit at a poker table and you've got 1,000 pounds in front of you, and you think, oh well, that could pay for this and that, so I'm gonna like protect, oh no, I've lost that bet, that's the price of a holiday, then you're gonna be terrible at the game. You need to detach from it. And so yeah, I think the same mindset applies in business.
Do you see business as kind of like a game?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't a game maybe undermines the importance of what we're doing in terms of like helping people treat very serious health problems. But ultimately, like, it's a lifelong game that I'm in of trying to get better and better at mastering all of these dynamics. And you're trying to bring together like you can't control timing, and so that is a bit of a game because the market moves in certain ways. And much back to my back to my reference earlier of Jensen Huang, the game is just how can you keep playing the next level? Can you survive long enough to play the next level? And each time you do, you've got the learnings, you've got more resources. Okay, let's go to level four and then level five.
I imagine like poker, it can become quite addictive as well. Just that dopamine roller coaster of,
Oh
the
yeah.
reward and
Yeah. Well,
then the risk.
yeah, I think that's why entrepreneurs don't stop. When people say, oh, why does this person like not just retire and go live on a beach? Well, like, would you say that to Cristiano Ronaldo when he's in the peak of his career? Why do you keep playing football? Like, why not just go and retire? I'm sure he had 100 million quid by a young age. Well, it's not about the money. He loves what he does, and he's it is dopamine for him. And so yeah, I definitely think I'm addicted to company building.
And in that context, like, what does success look like for you? Is it about like growth metrics, or has that shifted?
Yeah, well, I guess if you look at like a company like Skin and Me, like growth has to be the key indicator of success, because if we're growing, that means we're delivering value to our customers, and that means we get more resources in order to grow our impact. Yeah, I mean, for me personally, yeah, I always want to be getting better and better at just finding ways to get more leverage and have more impact in building health companies. So I've got this new one that I'm gearing up to launch, which I'm putting all of my time into at the moment. And then I want to grow as an entrepreneur in terms of my ability to do that more and more.
Brilliant. Well, James, thank you so much for chatting with me. Appreciate how busy you are, so I will let you go. But really enjoyed this chat and hope you did as well.
Yeah, I did. Thanks for your time, Viola.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.